Thanks for tuning in. This is David. On the program schedule tonight, we've got Ken McDermott Rowe and Gus Cantalero. Did I get that right?
Cantavero.
With
In Context.
In Context. And at 11 o'clock, we've got a program. We're going to talk about something completely inverse to Ken's program. We're going to be talking about Homer and Jethro, the great Nashville comedians and musicians. Homer and Jethro.
Is my mic on?
Not yet.
Okay, there we go.
Anyway, I've got a. I think I found a good theme song for you, Ken.
For In Context. Okay,
yeah.
Let's give it a shot.
I want to run it by you. So tell me what you guys got your headphones on, right?
I do.
And you're going to take phone calls.
We are going to take phone calls.
Let's describe the program before we run
it. The name of the program is In Context. It's sort of a live evolution of my series, History Counts. And my name is Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'm here with co-host Gus Cantavero.
Hello, good evening.
And what we're doing is in History Counts, we would analyze in long-form interviews a particular subject, but it was pre-recorded. This time we want, in this incarnation of the show, we want to have audience involvement. So we're going to take important contemporary issues, some particularly ones that aren't well covered in the corporate media and the networks, and we're going to discuss them, give analysis, and also invite listeners to participate. So we'll be giving out the phone number in a few minutes tonight.
Well, you could give it. All right, so let me play the theme, your new theme,
right?
Let's see. You'll take it from there. All right.
Great.
Are you ready, Ken?
Go with it. Welcome to In Context. We're going to discuss some important issues tonight, and we'd like you to participate. We're going to be giving out the phone number in just a couple minutes, but this is WPKN's fall fundraising period, and I just want to mention that we're trying to raise $89,500 to keep the station going in our fall fundraising drive, and we'd really appreciate your support. WPKN brings you a lot of important public affairs programming, like In Context, but we also bring you a diverse musical selection, like Dave's show that you're going to hear tonight. And we really need to your help to stay on the air. Why? Because we don't have corporate supporters. We don't have advertising, corporate underwriting. We don't get government grants. We're able to do what we do because of your generous support. For example, Gus and I did a program on 9/11, and we presented information that you just weren't going to hear in corporate media. And people stepped up and supported that show with a premium we were offering. And we hope that you'll support WPKN so that we can continue to bring this kind of programming to you. You can go make a donation right now by going to WPKN.org, and you can make a donation there or call in during the week. The fundraising will be going on during this coming week, so please help us out and keep us on the air. We only have one full-time employee. Your money's not being squandered here. We're bringing you the diverse programming that you can't get in the corporate media, so please lend a hand.
All right, so did you like your theme song?
It was
so grandiose.
It was very grandiose. We're maybe more modest than that.
I don't know if we're worthy of such an entrance.
I'm thinking maybe Walter Cronkite.
Well, the maple table that you've garnered here is fabulous also.
That's
the accoutrement,
right.
The accoutrements in the studio.
Pretty luxurious digs here.
We do. Well, we shouldn't say that. I mean, the fundraising is going toward building much more luxurious.
Yeah, studios. We're being pretty facetious here. It's pretty bare bones.
Very humble. Anyway.
Some of the issues we'd like to look at tonight would involve foreign affairs. And
yeah.
Gus, you've been looking at recently the China, our difference with China over trade, concern with the value of their currency. Mm. What's your take on that?
That's a topic that can just give you a headache within minutes. You can look at it, and there are so many differing opinions. And of course, what I'm talking about is this past week, we had a new development and the constant struggle between foreign currencies and the American dollar and the countries around the world and how they have such a devalued currency compared to the dollar. And so that's why, you know, job exportation has been such a problem for the past 20 years or so. First, it started out as being something that was a new idea, and it was going to, you know, float America on this ever-rising balloon of success, and we were just going to have to pay less and less for imported goods, and we would just continue to make money on doing nothing.
So whoever has the cheap currency has a competitive advantage, because
it would seem that way.
His products are going to be easier to export.
It would seem that way.
So we enjoy the cheap products, but on the other hand, we can't sell our stuff.
We can't sell a damn thing. And reading different people, different takes on this topic, they're all going to disagree. And it's really, really difficult to get to the bottom of it, because some people are going to obfuscate the truth and others are just going to say, no, it's all the capitalists' fault. And, you know, some people are going to be on the side of the unions. It's very hard to get to the bottom of. But if we just stick to the facts of the things that have happened over the past couple weeks, Congress just the other day passed a bill that was sold as a anti-Chinese good bill. And it was supposed to give the president the ability to impose tariffs on Chinese goods because, as Tim Geithner said, they are artificially keeping down the value of their currency. And until they let it rise, we're going to have to do something about it. But it was all just bluster. And the bill itself that was passed actually had the ability to impose tariffs stripped from it. All it was, I actually want to read a couple of passages here. This is by Barry Gray from Global Research. And this was October 1st, 2010. The House representatives on Wednesday passed a bill giving the executive branch the power to impose punitive duties on exports to the U.S. of any country whose currency is labeled fundamentally undervalued. The measure was pushed by the Democratic leadership and supported overwhelmingly by Democratic congressmen with substantial Republican support. The bill was supposed to be directed toward China. Under mounting pressure from the Obama administration to more rapidly raise the exchange rate of its currency. And the White House has not taken a position on the bill, whose prospects for passage by the Senate after the November midterm elections are uncertain. So they're passing half the bill and then holding off the Senate's part until after the election.
So this is grandstanding.
It's just total. It's nothing. Yeah. If passed the Senate and signed into law, the House bill would have little direct impact on U.S.-Chinese trade. A provision requiring the government to impose countervailing duties against any country deemed to be undervaluing its currency was stripped from the bill in the House Ways and Means Committee. So why, anyway, is it our government's responsibility to tell another country how to value its currency?
Well, one of the problems with the Chinese is that their currency is not traded in a free form on the international money markets the way the dollar is. So they, at least in the short term, can control how much it's worth.
Mm-hmm.
So they can use this as a matter of sort of trade warfare. And in a way, you know, you can't blame them if you can get away with it. Every country early in its economic rise has a national strategy, tariffs or whatever, to try to take advantage of it. And they're really besting us in this situation.
And the joke of it is that the Congressional Budget Office estimated that the bill would raise no more than $20 million a year in duties as compared to $1 billion in daily imports from China. And then, speaking from the floor of the House, Nancy Pelosi said, "We do this because 1 million American jobs could be created if the Chinese government took its thumb off the scale and allowed its currency to respond to market forces," quote unquote. And all she's doing is just passing the blame of our shitty, our crappy economy onto someone else.
If you'd like, we're talking about, this is Ken McDermott Rowe and Gus Canavero. The program is In Context. We're talking right now about our trade with China and the efforts that the Congress is making or trying to make to redress a huge trade imbalance with China. If you'd like to join the conversation and talk about this, or you have some other pressing issue that you'd like to air, now's your chance. Please give us a call at area code 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756. And tell us what's on your mind. Remember, the airwaves belong to you, the public, so we really want to hear what you think on these subjects. It seems to me in trading with countries like China, one of the big problems is they have a lower wage system based upon the fact that their workers do not have the right to unionize.
Right, of course.
They don't have any environmental protections. And It seems to me, while protectionism in the abstract is bad, well, and maybe it has a good place if you're a young economy trying to rise, but it would be reasonable for the United States to say, hey, look, if your country doesn't allow your workers to organize, if they're forced, if you have child labor, if you have all sorts of practices that we consider substandard, we should have perhaps a labor adjustment. And we will apply that to goods that you try to import to our country. And maybe we get other developed nations to adopt that standard, not just arbitrarily keep them out, but say, we got to level the playing field. If you're going to work 12-year-olds in your factory, if you're going to make people work, 16-hour days, then we're going to put a tariff on.
There's no comparison between the way our countries operate. Instead of creating incentives for companies to move back here, like we created incentives for them to move over there. Obviously, there was total incentivization for countries to offshore. There's no reason for them to stay here. They all get nothing but tax breaks, and they don't have to pay for things like health insurance and any kind of worker fair wages or anything like that to go over to another country. And, the Democrats, they pushed the bill as part of their Make It in America agenda. It's in quotes, to revive U.S. manufacturing. At the center of this policy is a doubling of U.S. exports in 5 years to be achieved by drastically cutting wages of U.S. workers and increasing their exploitation so as to narrow the labor cost differential between the U.S. and the so-called emerging economies of Asia. So they're just going to turn us into the new China.
This is it. This is it. This is it's the race to the bottom.
It's total crap.
Wage deflation, and I think people probably sing it. And callers, listeners out there, if you want to tell us about what your economic situation is like, we'd like to hear about that, because I know a lot of people out of work, and I know people who are in work are either afraid of they're losing their jobs, and sometimes they're getting wage cuts. I just got a notice yesterday from Stanford Library, and they said, we're reducing hours. It would have been worse, but the employees have agreed to take a wage cut.
Oh, thank God. It could have been worse.
All right, it could have been worse. So why are people taking wage cuts? Why is this, why are we in this downward spiral? There must be some better way to run things.
Did someone else curse?
The Chinese. So the economy of using lower waged people, lower waged countries that have lower wages, employees with no rights, no unions, that's better for us, isn't it?
If you just want to watch football and sit on your couch, sure.
Well, I want cheap clothes at Walmart.
But if your workers aren't making anything, eventually they're going to run out of money to buy things.
But if I'm not making anything, I want cheap clothes. If I have to spend a lot of money on clothes.
Well, it's a downward spiral, though.
It is.
It's easy to sell to someone and say, look, you're poor, you need Walmart. Say, oh, yeah, you're right. But if I had a good job and I was making more money, I wouldn't need Walmart.
But, the trade policy has to be part of an overall economic plan. If all you do is erect a wall around your country one way or the other, just tariffs or whatever, playing with the currency, you're not going to gain. I think we have the other important part of the pie is we have to have a national growth policy. And we've got to take massive amounts of capital and start putting them into things which are going to increase American wealth. Mm-hmm. We should be spending trillions of dollars building a new efficient energy.
Well, we are increasing American wealth, but it's only in a very small sector.
Yeah, exactly. That's a key point.
Exactly.
We're only increasing the wealth at the top.
I'm talking about the productivity of America, and that takes investment.
Right.
And what we saw in our program with Paul Kennedy called the Rise and Fall of Great Powers is that we're going down the path of every important Western power before Spain, the Dutch, the English. We're spending all this money on military and we're neglecting our core economy. And it's rotting from the inside. And that's the same thing that happened to the British as they went on their way down.
Your importation policy should just be to import things that you don't have domestically, right?
Right.
I mean, we don't need to import tube socks.
Exactly. And so that's very important when you're trying to build an economy. As we were in the 19th century, the Japanese after World War II, when you're building, you're on your way up, you don't spend money on the military. You spend money on investment at home, and then you selectively protect certain industries that you're trying to nurture. Now, I don't know how that would relate to us now. We don't want to protect our auto industry, I don't think. It's a mature industry. It should be competitive. But on the other hand, if we have a new solar industry that we're trying to, which we're not really very aggressively doing, a new windmill industry, whatever, it makes sense to protect that temporarily until it gets on its feet.
Germany invested in the solar, and they're the leaders. They're the world leaders in solar technology.
And I understand the Chinese are way ahead of us in the manufacture of solar cells.
I guess the Chinese are
so,
up there with everything.
So by being the leaders, that means that they can sell it for the cheapest amount.
They take advantage of their natural resource, which they don't have to import, which is labor. they have an overabundance of labor, and they can make it as low as they want because the people can't ever demand more.
Right.
Well, we've got to be smarter, and we got to invest. I'm talking to my son, who's a gamer. He's saying that the internet's faster in Korea.
Right.
And I'm saying, for crying out loud, why would the Koreans have a better internet system than the United States? I mean, why aren't we investing in this? So why do we have this antiquated electrical grid?
It's by far faster. It's not even like a little faster. It's by far.
Is that right?
It's like 6 or 7 times faster.
And that's a really key.
The things that you
gamer.
Have to pay for a major upgrade here in America, like Optimum Online, locally here in Connecticut, they have 3 levels. There's Boost, and then whatever the top one is, like Turbo or Optimum, whatever that gets called. But it's $100 a month more.
It's called Pickpocket.
And so even if you get the high speed one, you're still not up to what they have in
Korea.
I guess you're probably about that. Yeah.
But that's what they have for their national
welfare. This is the future of your country. We should be putting money into this.
And you know, unfortunately, this just sparked the thought. We've heard of Google investing in the next internet grid. And the government has talked about, people in the government have talked about the making the internet a public utility.
Yes.
And it would basically be free. It'd be like your tax money, but they'd give it to you. But the problem with that is then you now are subjecting yourself to government censorship because you'd have to play by their rules. So it's like getting welfare or food stamps or bringing your children into, you know, publicly provided daycare. You know, you're listening to their rules. You allow them to look into your finances and everything.
You get into the role of government. But
they become your daddy.
Even with the private internet, I think our privacy is being compromised. I saw that
illegally,
but just last week, here's an article from the LA Times that I noticed. A former CIA director, Michael Hayden, said the president of the United States should be given the authority to shut down the internet.
Yeah, sure. Why not?
So that's where we're coming, and of course the government wants to have greater access to your emails. You know, it's part of the search and seizure, and we're talking about money. Where does the money go? The new estimate for the cost of the war on terror by Joseph Stiglitz, who was a Nobel Prize winning economist, is now over $4 trillion. He wrote a book called The $3 trillion War, and he said recently it was an underestimate. And a lot of that is from
New Revised Edition.
A lot of that is from the future cost of all the disabled Americans who've come back from Iraq and Afghanistan. Half a million veterans have applied now for disability.
And you know, most of them don't even get full coverage, because if the only way to get 100% coverage on a lot of their injuries is to claim PTSD.
Is that right?
Yeah, and if you claim PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, then you give up a lot of your civil liberties, like you no longer have the ability to own a weapon or anything.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So that's the price you pay for getting
help.
Yeah,
you give up your Second Amendment.
Veterans are probably pretty reluctant to do that.
Yeah.
Ken, you were going to give out the phone number?
Thank you. Thank you for that reminder. The phone number is 203-336-9756, 203-336-9756. Please, we'd love to have you join the conversation. We're talking right now about China, but if there's something else in your mind relates to your personal economic situation, you'd like to air some suggestions about how you think we can deal with the terrible economic crisis we're facing, we'd love to have you share it with our audience.
Well, you were talking about low-wage earners here. It's really knocking on our door.
Oh, you make a good point. I actually have some material here. Let's find it. This is from Paul Craig Roberts, the great writer, formerly from the Reagan administration. He was the chief economist in the Reagan administration.
He was, I think, assistant at Treasury Secretary.
Treasury Secretary.
So very qualified.
Very qualified. He says, I have a couple lines here. He says, the enormous and continuing U.S. debt. Oh, by the way, this was written in 2007, and I pulled this out of the archives because I wanted to prove how predictable this was and how true it is. You know, 4 years later, he wrote this, the enormous and continuing U.S. deficits are wearing out the U.S. dollar as reserve currency. A time will come when the U.S. cannot pay for the imports on which it has become ever more dependent by flooding the world with ever more dollars. Offshoring and free market ideology are turning the U.S. into a third world country. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, 1/4 of all new U.S. jobs created between June 2006 and June 2007 were for waitresses and bartenders. Almost all of the new U.S. jobs in the 21st century have been in domestic services. Free market economists simply ignore the facts and proceed with their ideological justifications of open borders, a policy that is rapidly destroying the ladders of upward mobility of the U.S. population.
It's a policy that's serving the interests of very few people.
Very few.
Not serving the national interest.
Yeah, and Tim Geithner said just the other day that he's going to just inflate He's just going to increase the rate of inflation because they just don't have enough money to pay for things. And
you know, they keep printing money, but it hasn't brought back the market.
Clearly, the people who run the show, as Dave said, it benefits only the few. Those are the people who would benefit from inflation because they get the money first, then they trickle it down to everybody, and then they're the ones that have to pay the invisible tax.
And as we've learned from the Web of Debt series we had with Alan Brown, the whole system of creating money in the system of this country now is sort of a scam on the average person.
Right.
Because the Federal Reserve is actually loaning us money that we have to pay interest on, money that we could have created in the first place. There's another aspect to this.
We have a phone call.
Let's take it.
Hello, listener.
Oh, no, they're not there. They're not there. Hang on a second. Oh, you had a phone call.
Cold goal's gone.
Try again, Ken. Sorry about that.
Okay, good. The number again is 203-336-9756. I think we're talking about this economic rivalry with China, but of course, what's emerging now is a great global military rivalry, and it really began with the end of the Cold War. We defeated the Soviet Union, and as immediately in 1991, we began our drive for world hegemony. And that's, you know, we call it, we were there to save the Kuwaitis or whatever the heck it is. Now it's the so-called war on terror. But it's a drive for hegemony to control the key oil routes. And it's pretty clear now that the lines are being drawn with China and Russia on one side and the U.S. and whoever can bring with it on the other side. And this alliance between China and Russia, since we began this drive for hegemony, is becoming very strong. And just this past week...
We have a phone call.
Oh, good evening.
Good evening.
Hello. Go ahead, caller.
Hi, caller. You're speaking to Ken and Gus.
Hey, Ken and Gus. It's Norm. Actually, I was just calling to find out the music that you had at the top of the show. Can you tell me who that was?
Well, Dave would know the answer to that.
You know, you got to get back to what's really important. That was NRBQ.
Was it? Okay. Well, then that's really important. But another comment. You may want to think about the aspect of the economy that's really a credit-driven economy.
Uh-huh.
And I think, quite frankly, what would help us, my thought right now, is if we could find a way to for banks to loosen up credit so small business could have more capital to borrow to finance their growth.
Do you think it's just a matter of being able to borrow more? I mean, don't you feel that borrowing was part of the problem?
Well, it was part of the problem, but when companies and individuals over-leverage themselves, we're talking about stable companies right now that have good revenues, a lot of projects out there that they're waiting to take advantage of, but they can't because they can't.
So why isn't the money, the money's been created, the trillions of dollars has been made available by the Federal Reserve to banks, why aren't they lending it?
One thing is that banks can't take a hit to their, if they make a bad loan. And so they're actually, they can't afford to almost.
They just seem to be using it to fatten their, improve their balance sheets and make acquisitions of other institutions. But as you say, they're not lending it to business.
Well, we saw the first thing that happened when TARP was passed and the unlimited check for the bailouts, which we've already seen that the bill has come to $24 trillion, and we haven't seen an updated number in over 6 months. Bloomberg reported that.
Wait a second. Citibank just paid off their TARP last week, didn't they?
But that part of the money was there was a part that was reported, and then there was a part that was not reported. And the TARP money was only $750 billion, right? The rest of the money was totaled at $24 trillion.
This is what they call the quantitative easing, when they just make money available, and it doesn't appear as an appropriation.
It was an unlimited balance sheet. It was a check that anyone could draw from for an unlimited amount of time. The TARP was sold as $787 billion, but that was an arbitrary number. It meant nothing.
Yeah.
It was the quantitative easing part of it was the 24 trill, and it's a blank check.
Well,
and
I think Norm's trying to get in there.
Yeah, go ahead.
No,
go ahead, Norm.
I'm actually driving this
Norm, what do you think about the idea of creating a new national bank? That's what Ellen Brown has been pushing. She's an authority on the Federal Reserve, and she thinks that what we really need to do is to create a national bank which will make direct loans, perhaps interest-free loans, just create the money as is done now in North Dakota. They have the only state-owned bank, and apparently North Dakota is the only state that's running in the black now.
Yeah, I think we we certainly should look at that, but I really believe in free enterprise, and I think that, you know, the American economy and the entrepreneurship in America, it's a great system. Granted, there have been some excesses in the past that have sort of created the problems that we're going through right now, but I really believe that as much as governments involved in making requirements on banks, at the same time, they should be part of the solution by nudging the banks in certain ways to be able to kind of lend money to stimulate growth, as well as monitor banks so they're not over-leveraging themselves.
All right. Well, thank you for your call.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Norm.
You know the caller?
Mm-hmm.
Next caller?
Hello.
Yeah, good evening.
Go ahead.
Ken and Gus here.
I think that something that a lot of people are missing is that what we're going through now in a lot of ways is the same thing that the country went through in the late 20s and early 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And what a lot of people are failing to accept as a sort of a reality is that when Roosevelt became president, one of the first things he did was call Joe Kennedy to Washington. And he told Joe, he said, look, Joe, you're an inside trader. You know how the game works on Wall Street. I want you to fix things so that this never happens again. As you know, the Securities and Exchange Commission was created, and the numerous laws controlling Wall Street were created, including Glass-Steagall, which separated the banks, the insurance companies,
right,
and the commercial banks.
Right, which was then repealed.
These have all slowly been repealed beginning at around 1971, I believe, with Nixon took us off the restricted gold price standard that had been set up by Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm.
What we need to do is reinstate all those laws. Because what Joe Kennedy saw was human nature in action. He saw unrestrained greed on Wall Street. He knew that these people are out there.
Mm-hmm.
If you do not control the situation, these people will find a way to exploit the situation.
It's very true. There have to be safeguards that protect the recklessness of you know, the big business chance takers and insulating them from the regular guys like you and I who don't have billions invested in stock.
Glass-Steagall was critical in doing that, and
right.
Robert Rubin was the key man right in repealing that under Clinton,
right.
And then he went and he benefited from it with the merger of Citibank and Travelers.
The big risk takers have to face risks.
Right, and then we had, too big to fail. Well, they took the risk. Why can't they take the fall?
Right. Well, caller, why do you think they didn't just put the Glass-Steagall back in? Isn't that what Volcker was recommending to Obama?
Because they didn't have the votes to get it through.
Well, because most of those guys are funded by the big banks who don't want that stuff reinstated.
Exactly. Exactly. Even Obama has taken lots of money from the banks.
Goldman Sachs.
Bill Clinton took lots of money from the banks.
What do you think of the too big to fail concept?
I'm not really sure exactly.
Well, should the big institutions, like I say, a Citibank, be allowed to fail? Should the government?
Yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
That will keep them honest. In fact, Citibank, as you probably know, went ahead and ignored Glass-Steagall even before it was repealed.
Right, and exactly. You bring up a good point there because you have these regulations, and I watch television all the time. And actually, I never watch television, but when I do put it on, I hear them say, "Oh, we need to regulate." And New York Times talks about, "Well, we need to regulate," and we need to, stick it to these guys. But what's ends up happening is that if you have the same cronies who were bought and paid for by the banking institutions writing the bills, you're never going to have an honest legislation. It's always going to be some kind of loophole that allows them to still get their way.
Essentially, what's happened is these white-collar criminals mm-hmm. have stolen pretty much all of the money in the U.S., and they've got it.
Yeah.
And no one's making any effort to get it back.
No, of course not.
Now, unless we get it back, that means the whole country's got to start over again from the bottom.
No, not only did they get, they steal all the money like a bunch of pirates that just came and boarded our ship and made off with pots of gold, but we have people like Geithner saying, no, we need to print more money so it devalues it. Not only do they take it all from us, but the $5 we have left is going to be worth a buck in 5 weeks.
He's
because they're
totally
going to print so much more.
And he needs to be gotten rid of. All of that bunch of cronies that Obama brought in that were all part of this problem, I think I know what he did. He figured, okay, you guys were part of this problem. Now I want you to come up with a solution. And they have failed. They have failed to come up with a solution because here we are, almost 2 years later, we're still in just about as much of a recession as we were in the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Well, some people say that Obama's really just a third term of Bush Jr., and when you look at his major policies, there isn't a whole lot of difference.
No, he's not rocking the boat, and that's because he's afraid that if he does rock the boat, Wall Street, and as you saw from this Supreme Court decision recently that allows corporations to spend unlimited amount of money directly in elections,
right. Yes.
What that will mean is if he goes head-to-head with the big money, he knows he can't win because they will simply totally propagandize the whole country, spending endless amounts of money. The average person hasn't got a clue what's really going on, and they're so inundated. As you know, the middle class really has not had a raise in 30 years.
That's right. That's right.
Everybody's
just stagnate.
Struggling, and they're trying to keep up with the Joneses, and they're doing whatever they can. The thing is, the New Deal essentially has been repealed. They started it little by little by little with Nixon, and they did more of it with Bush Sr., and they did more of it
with
Clinton,
Reagan.
And Bush the second there.
Right.
He simply extended the whole thing. When the dot-com bubble burst back in 99 or 2000, whenever that was, essentially, that was a signal that the whole banking concept that they were pushing was creating a totally false picture of the wealth of the nation. And people were thinking they were making money, but in fact, the government was just running the presses, allowing unlimited amounts of credit. Even Alan Greenspan has said he made a mistake. And, you know, so people just spent and spent and spent because they didn't know what else to do.
Well, then, of course, after the dot-com bubble burst, then they had to come up with some new scam, and it turned out to be real estate.
Exactly.
And that propelled us through another decade and made a lot of these bankers even richer.
No, it's just boom, bust, one after another.
So what's next?
What we're facing as a nation is this. We have a tremendous conflict. Do we want to be a nation of complete, pure, totally unfettered capitalism, which some people want?
Yeah.
Or do we want to be a nation with some sort of combination of regulated capitalism with some social guarantees?
Yeah, this is
actually what we want to do a show on probably next month. We want to talk about the differences between an actual free market and what we have, which is a crony capitalist free market. It's not a free market.
It's not a free market. When you have
it's
huge
a rigged
corporations,
casino.
They can corner the market, and that's what you've got.
You know, in a free market, I know that's a so-called progressive or something. They would say, well, you don't want a free market because then that means you'd have a lot of people who actually could lose out on the system, and then they'd be poor. You don't want that, right? You don't want any social net to protect you from falling. But at least in that system, you have the ability to make profit off of your own idea instead of being undercut and overthrown by people who have back channel influence into the government.
Well, yeah, under crony capitalism, we privatize the profits and nationalize the losses.
Exactly. So we have a road that we paid for with taxation, which no one complains. We want the road, but we don't want it then licensed to a private company who can then reap the profits off of the toll.
But then the question is, how do we break the hold of these large corporations on our government? Where it seems like we're just spectators. And caller, what do you think? Is there some Gordian knot that can be cut in order to bring the average person back into the game?
I think a big thing that would make a difference is if the quasi-monopoly that we have in the press mm-hmm. and the media is broken up.
Yes.
All of those consolidations that were allowed during the 80s and the 90s to allow different radio stations and
exactly.
TV stations and
Clear Channel
yes.
to merge, this was supposed to bring greater efficiencies and more clarity.
No.
All it's done is created the same thing that happened back in the early 1900s when you had the Hearst newspaper empire battling against the Tribune newspaper empire. You had a few people that were the voices of opinions that were fed to the people. The people only had a few choices. When this country was founded, there were newspapers almost on every corner.
Well,
whoever had
yeah.
a press would print the sheet.
And that's today's blog.
And that's today's blog.
That's
but,
right.
You know,
and
not
lost
everybody
that.
Does. Not everybody does computers.
Right, exactly. I know. Of course.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us tonight, Colin.
We
really appreciate it.
Sure.
We'll give you. We'll give you a gong.
And that, well, the callers is really. Putting a point on what we're trying to do here at WPKN, because we're one of the few alternative voices.
Exactly.
I mean, you turn the dial, for example, the show we did on 9/11, we were on 9/11 presenting all this information. You didn't hear any of it.
No.
CNN, MSNBC, you could turn the whole dial. None
yeah.
of that stuff.
You could, and
that,
the reason for that is because you can't follow the money tree up and find Disney.
That's right.
Or GE, you know, or something.
We do it here, and we were one little corner, but the whole media should be opened up. Paul Wellstone understood that. He was, before he was he had his untimely death, that was one of his major concerns was this concentration issue. You can't have a democracy if you don't have a diversity in the media. Although it was what the famous Nazi propagandist Goebbels said, you must in the media you should have the appearance of diversity. You have
which
one,
is what we have.
One voice, but the appearance of diversity.
Yeah,
I think
you have
that is
NBC, which promotes, you know, the left propaganda of a supposed progressive media, and you've got Fox on the right, which promotes a neoconservative, ultra. Conservative, insane.
And that defines the debate. And so a lot of ideas are never brought up.
You know, you can talk about how important the media is, and it is important, but I don't think it's the media that's driving the economy.
The media is absolutely essential to maintaining the status quo by controlling the parameters of discussion. Because we're never allowed, for example, to discuss, should we have a Federal Reserve? Perhaps there's no more important issue than the creation of money in our society. I think it's the linchpin for corporate control of our society. And when was the last time you heard somebody discussing the possibility of having a different money system on TV?
During the time when the bailouts were happening, you know, I remember no matter where I went, it was what everyone was talking about, but everyone had the same parroting echo that I saw someplace else or read in the Times or
a talking,
you know,
point.
It was a talking
yes.
point. And, you know, I remember my aunt and uncle coming over for Thanksgiving, and it was like, well, you know, they're too big to fail. You can't let them fail. Are you serious? You're going to bring that? They're too big to fail. Why not? What do I care?
How about we talk about the war? How often does somebody come on TV and say, you know, what the heck are we doing in Afghanistan and Iraq? We have no business there. We all know it was based on phony premises.
Yeah.
It's draining this country financially. You never hear that point of view. It's as if, should we shoot them with drones or should we shoot them with M16s? Yeah. That seems to be the debate.
How uncivilized are they?
Exactly.
On a scale of 1 to 10.
You know what I mean, Dave? Why isn't there a network that's a peace network? I don't say peace, but someone to present that point of view that we should say, let's say the point of view of Ron Paul. That says, you know, good Republicans don't fight foreign wars.
Yeah.
You know, President Eisenhower ended the war in Korea. He often cites that. That's a very important point of view that deserves to be represented. You just don't hear it.
No. So should we move on to...
Sure. Well, one of the important issues as we're talking about war is the cutoff of these convoys of the roads in Pakistan by the Pakistan government, and that's because of these drones. Now, we've been hitting them with drones for some time, but apparently when we killed some of the Pakistani soldiers a few days ago, three of them, the Pakistan government just closed one of the main routes. Now, this is very important because about half of the supplies going to our soldiers in Afghanistan are going on trucks through Pakistan. So shutting off the supply route really hurts us. And this is all in the backdrop of those, if you remember the WikiLeaks of all the secret documents from our military showed that for years now, the Pakistani government, through its secret service, the ISI, have been working with, fighting with the Afghan resistance, known as the Taliban, against the United States Army. This has been going on for years. The reports go back to 2006. These are reports from the U.S. military saying, what are you guys doing? We're finding evidence that you are funding, you're organizing, you're fighting with the Taliban.
Exactly. I mean, I printed this up for a while ago, but I never ended up using it. This is a report from New York Times, August 22nd. Pakistanis tell of motive in Taliban leader's arrest. And it says, when the Americans and Pakistani agents captured Abdul Ghani Baradar, the Taliban's operational commander in the chaotic port city of Karachi last January, both countries hailed the arrest as a breakthrough in their often difficult partnership in fighting terrorism. But it goes on to say that the CIA, that originally the story was that the CIA and the and Pakistan worked together,
yes,
to arrest him.
Yes.
But then they say later on, Pakistani officials said that the CIA had nothing to do with it and that they arrested him on their own and that the CIA was working with the Taliban to undermine the Pakistani government. Yeah, that they were one was protecting each other.
One wonders what's really going on between the U.S. and the Pakistani government. At this point, what can the U.S. do if the Pakistanis are in fact supporting the Taliban? Are we in a position where we're going to have to overthrow the Pakistan government and widen this crazy war even further? We're really in a very difficult situation if Pakistan is in fact allied with the Taliban. And of course, we see everything through this prism of this war on terror that Bush invented in order to justify the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq. But the people there don't. They play along with this a little bit, but Pakistan's got different interests. They're worried about whether India is going to control the government of Afghanistan. I think that's really what's going on from their perspective. Taliban, useful to them.
Mm-hmm.
Hamid Karzai, I think they see him as an ally of India. So they just as soon get rid of him. And in fact, one of the discoveries when the WikiLeaks report documents came out was that the ISI, the Pakistan Secret Service, was organizing a network of suicide bombers to operate in Afghanistan. Is this unbelievable?
Yeah. Yeah, there's a quote in here that says, this is in regard to Pakistan arresting the leader of the Taliban. He says, this is a national secret, he said. The Americans and the British were going behind our backs, and we couldn't allow that. Once the decision was made to detain Mr. Baradar, the Taliban leader was tracked to Karachi, a sprawling violent city of nearly 20 million people, where ISI agents waited for him to activate his cell phone.
Well, what do you think? Are we going to give up there? Are we going to have the smart? I mean, what we should do.
We won't, but we should.
What we should do is we should adopt a completely new foreign policy. We should learn from the British and all these empires before us that we're just sticking it to ourselves by fighting wars over the world. The moral issues apart, which the moral issues are very important, but just from an economic perspective, we're bankrupting ourselves with these wars.
Oh, yeah.
And meanwhile, what are the Chinese doing?
And we're turning our troops into shells of what they used to be.
Of course. It's doing to these young Americans.
And denying them care, you know.
It's terrible on every level.
Yeah, yeah.
And the Chinese, of course, their economy is prospering. And they are lending us money.
Right.
They are lending us money so that we can build our military and fight these stupid wars.
And meanwhile, right? Just to keep it going, we have just the other day, this is a headline from Infowars.com by the prolific writer Kurt Nimmo. Absurd terror threat arises in midterm home stretch. We have a travel warning of Americans to go to Europe. And I was watching the news this evening, and it was, they said, we're not telling you not to go. We're just telling you to take more care. How could you take more care and travel? Like, I'm just going to report everyone who looks suspicious. Is that what they want you to do? And of course, they say that it's Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda.
Well, who knows if this stuff is true. But listeners, thank you for joining us. You've been listening to In Context with Gus Cadavero and Ken McDermott Rowe on 89.5 FM WPKN in Bridgeport, Connecticut. And we will be on again because of fundraising, our Wednesday show. We're usually on the first Sunday of the month at 10 p.m. and the first Wednesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. Our next show, because of fundraising, we won't be taking calls. But we will be back taking calls in November the 3rd, that's Wednesday at 6:30, and November the 7th, Sunday at 10 p.m. So we hope that we'll be able to make contact with you in our next shows in November.
What about your blog and your websites for this?
It is incontextreport.com.
And we put up our some thoughts that we have on various issues. We have archives, and we also like to have comments from visitors. So please check out the site.
Can I have your phone number and your address?
That we go with Ken's on that one.
That's right. But you can reach us through the blog incontextreport.com.
All right, Ken and Gus, thank you very much.
Thank you, Dave.
I got
thanks,
a nice
Dave.
Little outro song here.
Can you use any money today? 2 million, 4 million, 6 million, 8 million, 10. Take what you want, when it's gone, you can come back again. Bills that haven't been printed yet, you can have them by the sack. Coins that haven't been minted yet, that you never have to give back. Money, 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 Uncle Sam puts it right on the line. And if we ever run out, underground, there's a cave full of gold. Back up a truck and we'll fill it with all it can hold. Take 10 million and please don't fuss if you find it can't be spent. You can lend it right back to us and we'll pay you 7%. Money, 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 Uncle Sam puts it right on the line. And if that fellow with whiskers ever should decline, you can have mine.